Good evening, my very dearly beloved brethren and sisters and young people. It is in the goodness and mercy of our loving Heavenly Father that once again we have the opportunity to gather in such a large number as we have here to consider our main theme throughout these activities of Jonathan, whose love was wonderful. We have seen in our first two studies together his loving dedication and his loyalty to all around him, and especially to his Heavenly Father. And tonight we are to be led in a consideration to the theme, Jonathan, the Comforter, repeated pledges and quiet consolation. And we're going to have a look at the covenants that Jonathan made with David, renewed, and the comfort he offered to David when there was but a step between him and death as he fled from Saul. So let us then open with the words of David as they are found in Psalm 19 by singing together hymn number 12 to be followed by prayer. Our brother Roger has chosen for a introduction to his theme tonight, Jonathan the Comforter, that we should read together from the first book of Samuel at chapter 20 from verses 1 through to verse 23. We'll call upon our brother Michael Hill to read that for us.
From God's inspired word, 1 Samuel 20 from verse 1 to 23. And David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life?" And he said unto him, "God forbid, thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either great or small, but that he will show it me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." And David sware moreover, and said, "Thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes." And he saith, "Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as Yahweh liveth, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death." Then said Jonathan unto David, "Whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee." And David said unto Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. If thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me that he might run to Bethlehem his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he say thus, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of Yahweh with thee. Notwithstanding, if there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself, for why shouldest thou bring me to thy father?" And Jonathan said, "Far be it from thee, for if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would not I tell it thee?" Then said David to Jonathan, "Who shall tell me, or what if thy father answer thee roughly?" And Jonathan said unto David, "Come, and let us go out into the field." And they went out, both of them, into the field. And Jonathan said unto David, "O Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, when I have sounded my father about tomorrow any time, or the third day, and behold, if there be good toward David, and I then send not unto thee, and show it thee, Yahweh, do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do thee evil, then I will show it thee, and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace. And Yahweh be with thee, as he hath been with my father. And thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of Yahweh, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, Let Yahweh even require it at the hand of David's enemies. And Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Then Jonathan said to David, Tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed because thy seat will be empty. And when thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand, and shalt remain by the stone Ezel. And I will shoot 3 arrows on the side thereof, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a lad, saying, Go, find out the arrows. If I expressly say unto the lad, Behold, the arrows are on this side of thee, take them, then come thou, for there is peace to thee and no hurt, as Yahweh liveth. But if I say thus unto the young man, Behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away. And as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, Yahweh be between thee and me forever.
Brother Michael, for that reading. Let us then give attentive ears to the word of our God as we are led in the third study to the theme, Jonathan the Comforter, Repeated Pledges and Quiet Consolation.
Thank you, Brother Chairman. My dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, on the occasion of our last study, you'll recall that we left Jonathan as a wonderful prototype of the disciples, having been invited into a covenant of friendship with the Beloved. And that all that was required of him in the performance of that covenant would be that he should acknowledge the superiority of his friend. And that we also, as the disciples, typed by Jonathan and David, have been called into a relationship of covenant friendship with our Lord, provided we're prepared to acknowledge his superior right to the throne and to strip ourselves of all worldly ambitions and desires and to acknowledge that we stand defenceless before him and in his power. And we recall that wonderful example of tactfulness by which Jonathan sought to win the heart of his father back to the cause of David. The work and the responsibility of all the disciples of Christ to reconcile those that are opposed to him before he ascends his throne. Well, in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 20, as we have it set before us this evening then, all Jonathan's good work of the 19th chapter, unfortunately now, had come to the point where, because of the iniquity of his father, was about to become undone. And we're told in the first verse that David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, What have I done? What is mine iniquity and what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? And you know, when you read verse 1 carefully, we're impressed with the idea that here is David very agitated in spirit. You see it in the words? You see the triple statement of agitation here. What have I done? What is mine iniquity? What is my sin? These are the words of an agitated man. And you see, the thing that upset David more than anything else was this. Not just that Saul was hostile to him, but that Saul had never ever charged him with a crime. David didn't know what it was. And the man who knew how to face Goliath had no idea in his youthfulness how to face a hostile brother. What have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? And if David is agitated in the first verse, Jonathan is distressed as a result of his friend's agitation in the second. Because we're told that Jonathan said unto him, God forbid. The phrase means, far be it from thee. Far be it from thee. Thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing either great or small, but that he will show it me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. One can imagine in the second verse here how upset Jonathan would be, how surprised he would be. You see, he thought that he had achieved a reconciliation in chapter 19 where Saul, his father, had sworn with an oath that David would not die. And now he finds that it's all come undone. And David's agitated triple statement of verse 1 is matched by three anguished denials from Jonathan in verse 2. You see them there? Far be it from thee, thou shalt not die, it is not so. You see those statements in the second verse? They match the three anguished calls of David in the first verse. This is Jonathan's response to his friend. Far be it from thee, thou shalt not die, and at the end of the verse, it is not so. He could hardly believe his ears. He knew that Saul had discontent against David. He knew that his father had a measure of hostility towards this young lad, but Jonathan could not believe that his father would murder David in cold blood. He couldn't believe that. Now, you know, there's two things emerge from the second verse, and they are this. The first thing is that if you believe what Jonathan says here, as I'm sure we do, Jonathan cannot have been aware of the events of chapter 19 from verse 8 onwards. If we go back a page, chapter 19 verse 8, there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and they fled from him, and the evil spirit from Yahweh was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand. And we have the incident of the javelin and the incident of Saul sending messengers to watch over David's house to slay him in verse 11, and the escape of David in verse 18, and the visit of Saul to Ramah in verse 22 in order that he might chase after David. Jonathan can't have been aware of any of that story. For him to be so surprised in chapter 20, verse 2. Now there's two possible explanations as to why it could have been that Jonathan was not aware of the later events of chapter 19. The first reason is, or the first possibility is, that he may have been away on the king's business fighting elsewhere. May have been away from the royal court, completely unaware of what had happened. The other reason, which is also perhaps even in some ways more likely, is that those matters had in fact been concealed from him. And that's borne out by verse 3. Because David says in verse 3, thy father certainly knoweth that I've found grace in thine eyes, and he said, let not Jonathan know this. So some of these later incidents in the balance of chapter 19 were no doubt concealed from Jonathan so that he was absolutely unaware of them, and they came like a thunderbolt out of the blue when David appeared before him in chapter 20, verse 1. And here's the other point that emerges from the second verse. Jonathan thought the best of his father. My father will not do this. Now, don't you think Jonathan knew what his father was like? He thought the best of his father, didn't he? He gave credit to his father. He imputed unto him at this stage the best of motives. I'm going to come back to that a little later on. Rotherham translates that final phrase at the end of verse 2, there is nothing in this. And he seeks to reassure David, his friend, in this regard. And no doubt Jonathan would have been distressed that maybe David thought that Jonathan was implicated in this last show of hostility towards him. Jonathan wants to make it clear that he knew absolutely nothing about those things. And so David now says in verse 3, in order to impress Jonathan with the extent of the adversity that lay upon him, he said, it says that David sware, moreover, and said, "Thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes." And he said, "Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved, but as truly as Yahweh liveth, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death." When it says in verse 3, he sware, moreover, we have the swearing of the statement later on in the verse, don't we? "As truly as Yahweh liveth." There it is. David sware, "As truly as Yahweh liveth, there is but a step between me and death." And you see, this was a new danger that David was now suggesting. He was saying that Saul had full knowledge of the close ties between Jonathan and David, and therefore on that ground alone, Saul could no longer be trusted to reveal his true intentions to his son. You know, Jonathan must have been shattered by this. Because one thing that seems to come out of the record is that up to this point of time, he'd enjoyed his father's full trust. They really were very close, this father and this son. And all of a sudden, Jonathan finds now that his father has deceived him. And to make matters worse, his father had deceived him only because Jonathan had sought to be faithful and just in the truth. That must have hurt. Because he'd sought to be faithful in the truth in the matter of David, he'd now forever lost his father's trust. That must have deeply upset Jonathan. No doubt it did. And yet he was obviously impressed with David's oath in verse 4, because in verse 3, because the fourth verse says, "Then said Jonathan unto David, whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee." Then said Jonathan. Then. When is then? And the answer is after David had sworn with an oath. Verse 3. David said, "As Yahweh liveth." And as soon as Jonathan heard that, "Then said Jonathan, as whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee." And you know, the very simplicity of the statement of verse 4 tells us that Jonathan had completely accepted the situation as being truthfully revealed. He was impressed with the certainty of David's conviction. And when you read verse 4, isn't it a lovely statement of the faithful attitude of all disciples to Christ? Isn't that where we stand? With Christ? "Whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee." That's our responsibility, isn't it, to Christ. And Jonathan sees that his relationship to David inevitably will affect his relationship with others. And his relationship with his father now has forever been changed because of his relationship with David. Isn't that the same for us in the truth? Matthew chapter 10, verses 35 to 37. "He that loveth father or mother more than me." And even for disciples who have parents in the truth, there is, in a very special sense, isn't there, a change of allegiance when one becomes baptized. Our relationship with Christ inevitably affects our relationship with other people. We have a new sense of commitment and dedication. And the dedication is, verse 4, that we say to Christ, "Whatsoever thy soul desires, I will even do it for thee." And so David said in the fifth verse, he said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat." Septuagint actually translates that in quite a different way. The Septuagint says, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I shall not on any account sit down to eat." So the Authorized Version says, "I ought to sit down." The Septuagint says, "I certainly won't." Maybe the balance of the matter lies in between those two, that he certainly ought to have, but didn't want to. And so he says, "Let me go, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. And if thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me, that he might run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he say, thus it is well, then thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. And so in verses 5 and 6 and 7, David and Jonathan plan a strategy whereby Jonathan might approach his father to find out his real feelings towards David. And of course the problem was this, that if Saul had already deceived Jonathan, and it was already possible, therefore, that he couldn't be trusted, that they somehow had to concoct a plan to seek a means by which the king would reveal his mind involuntarily. Something that would spontaneously cause Saul to reveal his mind had to be engineered in that way. And so David says, well, how about the suggestion of running down to Bethlehem? Incidentally, I think it's more than possible that David did go to Bethlehem. If he says, it is well, thy servant shall have peace, verse 7. If he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined of him. And you see, the benefit of the plan that they were arranging here in verses 5 to 7 was that not only would it reveal Saul's true mind towards David, but that Jonathan would witness at first hand the evidence of his father's reaction. He'd be there to see. Any doubts that he might have would be clarified one way or the other as to where his father stood. It was a good plan in its way, really, wasn't it? And so verse 8 says, therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of Yahweh with thee. Notwithstanding, if there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself, but why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? You know, the Jerusalem Bible has a good translation of the early part of the 8th verse, renders it this way. Do this favour for your servant, since you have united yourself with him by a pact in Yahweh's name. You see, what verse 8 is telling us is that the friendship of this couple was not based upon mere social enjoyment or upon emotional ties. The basis of their friendship was a mutual reverence and respect for Yahweh and his truth. You have united yourself with him by a pact in Yahweh's name. That was the basis of their friendship. And it's the basis of all good friendships in the truth that will last and endure, a mutual reverence for God and a respect for his word. And David at the end of the verse, verse 8, because he's so anxious to retain the friendship of Jonathan, says, if there be in me any iniquity, slay me thyself, for why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? If there is something wrong in me, if maybe it is my fault, says David, if there is something that I've done to cause thy father's hostility, then kill me now, you, my friend. And Jonathan said, verse 9, far be it from thee. Incidentally, that phrase, far be it from thee, verse 9, is the same phrase, God forbid, in verse 2. There it is, the identical phrase. Far be it from thee. For if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would not I tell it thee? You see how Jonathan in this verse struggles against an immediate and an outright condemnation of his father. If I knew certainly, he says. He really struggles against condemning his father, doesn't he? And David says in verse 10, he said to Jonathan, well, who shall tell me, or what if thy father answer thee roughly? What if Jonathan himself ends up in trouble because of this matter and finds himself unable to communicate safely with David in the future? And you know, when you read all the words of David in this story, one gets the impression that here is a young man who's rapidly going to pieces. He's 20 years Jonathan's junior. And he might have been valiant in the Valley of Elah, but he is as yet a young man. And he doesn't know how to handle some of these situations in life. And Jonathan, David here in this chapter, is matched by all the uncertainty and the worry and doubts of a young person not quite used to handling the issues of life. He's in danger of falling to pieces. And it's Jonathan who takes charge of the situation. You see what he does in verse 11? Look at this. This is lovely. Jonathan said unto David, "Come, and let us go out into the field." And they went out, both of them, into the field. You see, David was so upset that he was beginning to, as it were, fall to pieces. And it's Jonathan that says, "Come on, come with me." And out into the field they go. You know, there were two reasons for going out into the field. The first was because royal walls have ears. And so whatever Jonathan was going to say, in order to console and strengthen his friend, he wanted to say where he was sure that no one would hear that conversation. "Come on, out into the field." And the second reason was, Jonathan is, as it were, saying, "Let's go to a quiet spot where we can quietly discuss how best to handle this issue. Because what we want to do, David, is to make sure that Yahweh might be honored and your life is preserved and I don't betray my father. So let's go and have a quiet chat somewhere so we can sort it out properly in the best interests of the truth." You see what he says in that verse? "Come and let us go out into the field." And they went out, both of them, into the field. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? That reminds you of an earlier episode in the Bible? "And Cain talked with Abel his brother, saying, 'Let us go into the field.'" Genesis chapter 4, verse 8. "And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. And Yahweh said to Cain, 'Where is Abel thy brother?' He said, 'I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?'" It's the identical phrase. "Come and let us go into the field." And what a difference between the story of Genesis chapter 4 and the 1st of Samuel chapter 20. Because you see, Jonathan's spirit was the very reverse of Cain's. He took David into the field because he intended to be his brother's keeper and to ensure that David's blood might not be shed. He did not have the jealous spirit of Cain. An interesting contrast, isn't it? Two men on two occasions who both go out into the field with exactly opposite intentions. And so having got out into the quietness of the field, verse 12 says, "And Jonathan said unto David, 'O Yahweh Elohim of Israel.'" That was a strange thing to say to David, wasn't it? Jonathan said unto David, "O Yahweh Elohim of Israel." In fact, the Jerusalem Bible and the Revised Version translate the phrase, "Yahweh Elohim of Israel, be witness." So as he begins to say his words now to David, he looks at David, maybe he put his hands on David's shoulders, but as he begins to speak, he says, "I want Yahweh Elohim of Israel to be witness of what I'm about to say." You know, there's a good lesson in verse 12. It's Jonathan in this story who brings God into the matter. All good plans in the truth invoke Yahweh's guiding hand. No good making plans without that. And that's something that young people need to learn, as well as old. And the older we get, the more we realize the truth of that statement. That all good plans invoke Yahweh's guiding hand in the matter. And so Jonathan no doubt deliberately said that in order to reassure David that what he was saying was not double-minded talk, it was the talk of a sincere heart. Let Yahweh be witness of what I'm about to say. And he says, when I have sounded my father about tomorrow, any time, or the third day, and behold, if there be good toward David, and I send it not unto thee and show it thee, then Yahweh do so and much more to David, to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do thee evil, then I will show it thee and send thee away that thou mayest go in peace. I will show it thee and send thee away. He would send David away. Because it was Jonathan's desire to send him away to preserve David's life that he might inherit the throne. That's why he's going to send him away. That David might be preserved to inherit the throne. And you see, Jonathan felt that he could do that without in any way compromising his loyalty to his father. You see, Jonathan's got this tremendously difficult thing to balance, hasn't he? How to help his friends and be constant as far as his father is concerned. And he felt that he could do this for his friend. He could sound out his father and, if necessary, send David away to preserve David's life, be loyal to his friend, without compromising his loyalty to his father. The spirit of Proverbs chapter 20, verse 5, in these two verses, counsel in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. When I have sounded my father, says Jonathan in the 12th verse. And that's what he was going to do. He was going to draw out the counsel of his father's heart, though it be in deep waters, and promised faithfully to David to show him whatever that might be and send him away if necessary to preserve his life. Now, you know, there's a marvelous principle that comes out up to this stage of this particular story, to the end of verse 13. Throughout this particular episode, in the conversation that goes between David and Jonathan, we have a principle here that stands as supreme in Jonathan's life. Let's have a look at this particular story. Now look first of all here then at the attitude of David in these verses towards Saul. Let's just run through this. Just one key phrase. Thy father. You see it there? Now look. The first of Samuel chapter 20 verse 1. What is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? Chapter 20 verse 3. Thy father saith, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. Verses 6 and 7. If thy father be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Chapter 20 verse 8. Slay me thyself, for why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? Verse 10. Who shall tell me, or what if thy father answer thee roughly? You see David's spirit towards the king? It's the words and the thoughts of a young man who's deeply worried about an older man who doesn't know how to handle him, and he's not very happy with Saul at all. Thy father, says David. Now look at Jonathan's spirit towards the same man. Chapter 20, verse 2. Why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Chapter 20, verse 9. If I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee. Not really to condemn him, is he? Chapter 20, verse 12. When I've sounded my father, and behold, if there be good toward David. You see what Jonathan assumes first? Good or evil? If there be good. Verse 13. But if it please my father to do thee evil. And verse 13 again, and Yahweh be with thee as he hath been with my father. That's honour. Honour thy father and thy mother. Don't you think that Jonathan knew what his dad was like? He knew the inconsistencies in his father's character. He knew them all too well. How easily it would have been for Jonathan in this particular chapter to agree with David and say, "You're quite right, I don't know what my dad's up to." He strove every moment of that story to give reverence to his father. There's a tremendous lesson there in Jonathan's life, isn't there? Even in his pledge of loyalty in verses 12 and 13 here about what he would do to David, even in pledging his loyalty to David, there's not one single ungracious word that ever escapes out of his lips about his father. There's a wonderful balance there. That's a divine principle. And you know, I believe that David was impressed with that principle out of Jonathan. Come to chapter 24 for a moment. 1 Samuel chapter 24, which of course is only a short while later, really. The 1 Samuel chapter 24 in verses 4 to 6. "And the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day of which Yahweh said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily, and it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, Yahweh forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, Yahweh's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him." Chapter 26, verse 8. "Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore, let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I'll not smite him the second time. And David said to Abishai, Destroy him not. For who can stretch forth his hand against Yahweh's anointed and be guiltless? And David said furthermore, As Yahweh liveth, Yahweh shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. But Yahweh forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against Yahweh's anointed." Now you might say that that was the spirit of David. I believe it was so. But I tell you what, that spirit of loving respect for Yahweh's anointed was nurtured in David by his contact with Jonathan. He was mightily impressed, I'm sure, by Jonathan's respect for his father. That principle, which no doubt was already in David's heart, was nourished and sustained by contact with this wonderful man. You know, there's a divine principle there, isn't there? The divine principle of honour. You know, I think the word honour is a better word than the word respect. You know, we say, well, we ought to show respect to people. But you know, the word respect has almost a bit of a sort of technical sound about it, perhaps clinical. One could perhaps show respect and yet be grudging. All right, well, I suppose I ought to respect them. You can't say that about the word honour, can you? The word honour conveys not just the sense of respect, but the reverential feeling that goes with that respect. Jonathan honoured his father. You know, that's a divine principle that's almost been lost in this world. But it's a principle for the disciples. And we take it out of the life of Jonathan. And here's the beginning of that principle. It all begins with our honour of God, doesn't it? Malachi chapter 1 verse 6, "A son honours his father and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is mine honour?" cries God in Malachi chapter 1. And if we've got the principle of honour correct in our lives concerning our attitude to God, then we will find inevitably that it will influence every other relationship that we have in life. Honour to God is the foundation stone of our life and attitude in the truth to all other people. What about honour within the family? Ephesians chapter 6, verse 2. Here's what Jonathan had done, wasn't it? Honour thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. You know, I've heard a saying that talks about the three ages of man. You ever heard the three ages of man? The first age is, my dad's bigger than your dad. And the second age is, the old man doesn't know much. And the third age is, my father always used to say. And that's just about what it's like in life, isn't it? From childhood through to adulthood, where we finally perhaps do appreciate what our fathers have really been like. Well, it oughtn't to be like that in the truth. Honour thy father and thy mother. That's a divine principle. It all ought always to be like that. And what about within the ecclesia? Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honour, the first of Timothy chapter 5, verse 17. It's not just the arranging brethren, is it? It's not just the elders of the ecclesia, the leaders of the ecclesia. Romans chapter 12, verse 10 says, concerning our relationships in the ecclesia, in honour, preferring one another. That's how we ought to deal with everybody in the ecclesia. In honour, preferring one another. Romans 12, verse 10. What about in the workplace? Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honour. 1 Timothy 6, verse 1. Oh, here comes the boss. Suppose I better get back on the job. Same thing at school, really, isn't it? How are you going, teach? Sometimes we have teachers who stand for things that we do not agree with. But we still teach our children to honour their teachers. Not always hard to find the balance, is it? We don't honour them for what they necessarily are in their life. We don't honour them for their character, nevertheless, but we honour them for the position they hold. We ought always to remember that. What about our affairs with the state? Romans 13, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, render their dues. Honour to whom honour. We do come into contact with those who are in charge of the government of the country. We might not think much of them. Politicians. Honour to whom honour. In its due and proper way. And it all springs out of honour to Yahweh. Now, that's a good principle for life, and it's one that we ought to be careful that we don't lose sight of, because the world has. And isn't Jonathan a marvellous prototype of that spirit in this chapter? He honours his father to a point that is almost unbelievable in his reverence and dignity for that man. Back to verse 14, the first of Samuel 20. Thou shalt not only, while yet I live, show me the kindness of Yahweh that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever, no, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. You see what he says in verse 14? Thou shalt not only, while yet I live. Now one could say that, well, Jonathan's just providing for the future. He was an older man, and the day would come when he wouldn't be around any longer. I think there might be more than that in this. I think that verse 14 is implying that Jonathan had a feeling of foreboding that all might not be well in the future. Septuagint translates these two verses as follows. And if indeed I continue to live, then thou shalt deal mercifully with me. And if I indeed die, thou shalt not withdraw thy mercy from my house. forever. I think Jonathan had a sense of foreboding that maybe something would befall his house, or at least his own life, before the story of this friendship would have run its course. And so in verse 14, and again in verse 15, you see what he says? Thou shalt not cut off thy kindness. No, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, everyone from the face of the earth. In other words, don't cut off your chesed, mercy, from me, even after your king. And what's interesting about that is, you see, in verse 8 of this same chapter, David said, thou shalt deal kindly, that's the word chesed, thou shalt show loving kindness unto thy servant. Jonathan says in verse 15, no, you show your loving kindness to me when you're king. These two men loved one another, brothers and sisters, young people. They really esteemed one another. Show kindness to me, thy servant, says David. No, says Jonathan, you show kindness to me when you're king. They esteemed each other. And of course, the reason for the kindness was that it was the practice of monarchs in oriental countries to exterminate rival houses to the throne. And Jonathan, as it were, is pleading that David would never descend to that level when he becomes king. He would show kindness to Jonathan's house. But what he's really doing, you see, is he's speaking with absolute conviction that as far as he was concerned, he had no doubt that David would become king. That was designed to buoy up David's spirits. Now, when you're king, says Jonathan, I want you to be kind to my house. You see, he's trying to lift David's thinking. And you know, David never forgot that pledge that Jonathan had sought from him. If you come to the 2 Samuel chapter 9, you'll remember this story, but just look at the context a little more closely. David never ever forgot that promise that Jonathan had wrung out of him in love in the field. In the 2 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 1 it says, and David said, is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness, that's chesed, same word, covenant, mercy, for Jonathan's sake? And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they called him unto David, the king said unto him, art thou Ziba? And he said, thy servant is he. And the king said, is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I may show thee chesed kindness of God unto him? And Ziba said unto the king, Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet. You know what's interesting about that passage? You see, the 2 Samuel, chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, are the five chapters in the 2 Samuel dedicated to David's wars. And it was in those five chapters that Yahweh cut off all the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And what Jonathan had said in chapter 20 and verse 15 was, that thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house, no, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And at in the very moment of time that Yahweh was indeed doing that to his enemies, David remembered that covenant. In the midst of his enemies being cut off, he remembered that pledge. And you see how chapter 9 here of the 2 Samuel verses 1 to 3 tells us that David went out of his way to honour that pledge. He said, is there anyone left so that I can fulfil that promise? He never forgot that, did he? And he did it at the very time that Jonathan had made reference to when Yahweh had cut off the enemies of David. And so in the 16th verse of the 1 Samuel 20, we're told that Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let Yahweh require it even at the hand of David's enemies. So Jonathan made a covenant. But they've already made a covenant in chapter 18 in verses 3 and 4. Why make another one? They've already sworn with an oath. It's already forever. It's already before Yahweh. Why make another covenant? Well, there are two reasons. Because the covenant of chapter 18 was made in the days of gladness. But now it's being repledged by two friends in the midst of trial. It was a renewing of the covenant in different circumstances of life. And the second reason is because it's now being extended not only to Jonathan and to David, but to their respective houses. You see verse 15? Thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house. Verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. It's being extended now to their respective seeds. And so we have the second then of the three covenants that were made between these men. Remember how their first covenant was established at the very time that their friendship began. And Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by giving him his royal garments and his princely weapons. And now we have the second covenant in the 1 Samuel 20 in verse 16. A covenant that's being repledged now amidst trouble and sorrow and trial that threatened their friendship. But the foundation stone of that covenant has not changed. And that's this. That Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by pleading for covenant mercy to be shown to both he and his house by David after God had established David as king and cut off all his enemies. The foundation stone of that covenant is Jonathan's acknowledgement of David's superior right to the throne. And there it is again. And you see, if you read the record carefully, it's Jonathan who takes the initiative again, isn't it? You see verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant. Verse 17, and Jonathan caused David to swear. It's Jonathan again who takes the initiative in this matter. Now you see, there's a lovely type here, isn't there, as far as the disciples of Christ are concerned. Every Sunday, we come as the disciples of the Beloved, and we renew the terms of our covenant with him. And we restate our pledge of affection and allegiance. And we vow afresh that nothing will come between us and our friendship with him. And we declare, like Jonathan, our conviction that soon he will be king, and that soon Yahweh will make his enemies his footstool. And to plead before him that in the day that he does come, that he will show the kethered kindness of Yahweh towards us. There's a type in that, isn't there? We all repledge our covenant with the Beloved in exactly the spirit that Jonathan showed on this occasion. And verse 17 says, and Jonathan caused David to swear again. But you know, I think the Septuagint translation has the better of it. It says, and again, Jonathan swear unto David. And then you take the margin of the Authorized Version, which carries on to say, by his love towards him. In other words, it was Jonathan that swore his love again to David. That's what the Septuagint translation says. And I think that that's right, because you see, what is going on in this chapter is that Jonathan is seeking to reassure David of his feelings. It's Jonathan who's seeking to reassure David of his love to David. And so reading the Septuagint and the marginal translation of the Authorized Version we have, and again, Jonathan swear unto David by his love towards him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Remember we said in our previous study that that phrase, he loved him as his own soul, occurs three times in the divine record. Chapter 18, verse 1. Chapter 18, verse 3, and here in chapter 20, verse 17. But notice that in this verse here, the very word love now occurs three times concerning Jonathan. He loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Proverbs 17, verse 17 says, a friend loveth at all times. And there's a principle that comes out of it. And here's the principle. You see how strong Jonathan was in his feelings towards David? Chapter 18, verse 1. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. Chapter 18, verse 1 again. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Chapter 19 and verse 2, but Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted exceedingly in David. Chapter 20, verse 17, Jonathan swore unto David by his love towards him. Chapter 20, verse 41, and they each one kissed his breast, and each one wept on his breast. And finally, the eulogy of David himself in the 2nd of Samuel 1, verse 26, thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. You know, one of the principles of true friendship is fervency. And you see, from the very beginning, Jonathan had absolutely lost himself in a consuming eagerness to further David's cause. He'd lost himself in an eagerness to further David's cause. And the strong feelings of Jonathan are a blueprint of how we ought to feel about Christ. There's the measure of how the disciples should feel about their Lord. And we're warned in the New Testament, aren't we? The love of many shall wax cold. That's not the spirit of Jonathan. I suppose we live in an age where apathy and indifference and mediocrity prevails. And it does affect us. And I think it does affect each generation progressively as time moves on. And it does affect our young people. Singing hymns? You watching everybody else? Some people sing hymns so miserably you wonder whether they've even read the words. There's certainly nothing fervent about the way they sing. Concentration in prayer? Do you really feel that you have an intensity about prayers that you can say amen at the end and have heard and understood every word and phrase? Attendance at ecclesial activities? Going to study weekend? Especially. Every one of us finds that there are burdens in the truth at times, and it's difficult to keep up our commitment, but the truth is all about that. Taking notes. A generation ago, there was reams of notepaper used in study. Sometimes, nowadays, you have young people that find it a dreadful struggle to even open their Bible. We are affected, aren't we? You see, what Jonathan felt about David, he really felt. And he felt it strongly within his whole being. He loved him as he loved his own soul. You know, brothers and sisters, and especially to young people, the truth is all about striving for the best. The truth is all about reaching for excellence. The truth is all about giving whole burnt offerings. The truth is all about fervency. Have you got it? The 1st of Peter chapter 4 and verse 8 says, above all things, have fervent love among yourselves. That's Jonathan, isn't it? Verse 18 says, that Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed, because thy seat will be empty. And when thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand, and shall remain by the stone easel. Septuagint translation, as marked by Rotham, says, translate that last phrase, thou shalt remain by that mound. Thou shalt come down to the place, says verse 19. Doesn't say where the place is. But we know that wherever the place of verse 19 was, it was a field, verse 24. So David hid himself in the field. And the place is described in verse 19 as the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand. And one feels that perhaps that's a reference back to the 19th chapter and in verse 2, when in the previous matter of seeking the reconciliation of David to Saul, Jonathan had said to David, "Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place, and hide thyself, and I will go and stand beside my father in the field where thou art." And now in chapter 20 and verse 19 he says, "You go down to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand." And we know from verse 24 that it's a field. And one therefore concludes that perhaps what Jonathan was saying to David was, "You go back to that field where you hid last time." And that was a thoughtful move on Jonathan's part, wasn't it? Because you see, what it would do is it would bring back to David the good memories of an earlier successful reconciliation. That was a thoughtful move on Jonathan's part, wasn't it? Suggest that he hid there. And so in verses 20 and 21 and 22, they make arrangements then for what they're going to do. And he says, "I will shoot three arrows on the side thereof, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a lad saying, 'Go, find out the arrows.' If I expressly say unto the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of thee,' take them, then come thou. For there is peace to thee and no hurt, as Yahweh liveth. But if I say thus unto the young man, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond thee,' go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away. And as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, Yahweh be between me, thee, and me forever." You know, if you read those words carefully, one thing that does impress us with Jonathan's speech is his extensive use of the divine name. Go back to verse 12. Yahweh, Elohim of Israel. Verse 13. Yahweh, do so. Yahweh be with thee. Verse 14. The kindness of Yahweh. Verse 15. When Yahweh hath cut off the enemies. Verse 16. Let Yahweh require at the hands of the king's enemies. End of verse 21. As Yahweh liveth. Verse 22. As Yahweh hath sent thee away. Verse 23. Yahweh be between me and thee forever. You know what he's really saying? Jonathan is openly confessing his conviction that Yahweh's guiding hand is in the whole matter. Jonathan says, "I believe that. We don't know what the answer is, David. I appreciate that. But I tell you what I do believe is that Yahweh's hand is in the matter." You see what he says at the end of verse 22? He says, "If the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away." Not Saul hath sent thee away. Not Jonathan hath sent thee away. Not circumstances have sent thee away. Yahweh hath sent thee away. He says, it's all in the divine hand. You need to believe that, David. You rest in the guardian care of the Father. See, Jonathan had a belief in the providential care of God. Not always easy for us to believe in times of trial, is it? And then in verse 23 he says, "And as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, Yahweh be between me, between thee and me forever." And so in this story then, as we come to the conclusion, we have here the two men out in the field and the giving of Jonathan's counsels of assurance to his friend. Story of quiet consolation in the field. But those we've all got to ask ourselves in our relationships one with the other, how do you see yourself in the main with your brethren? Are you principally found in the role of comforter and sustainer and encourager? Or is most of your life with brethren spent in combat and aggression and confrontation? You decide for yourself. Now, we're not saying that there aren't times when we need to stand up to another person in the truth, on occasion. What we're talking about here is the overall spirit of the truth. You know, everybody needs friends that can provide comfort. The very cry of Messiah in Psalm 69 and verse 20 is, I looked for comforters, but I found none. We all need that. And the words of a friend that can provide comfort can often win a heart to the truth. Where all the hard words and all the strong words and all the swords would never, ever change them. And you see what Jonathan did here in this particular story. Let's just review what he did here as we review what Jonathan did as the comforter of his friends. You see, you've got to understand what comfort is. You see, true comfort is not commiseration. Comfort is not saying to a person, look, I really feel so sorry for you. Or I really feel so sorry for us. Or I really feel bad about all of this. Or I feel so upset about what's happened. That's not Bible comfort. True comfort from a scriptural point of view involves seeing the problem from the other person's perspective and then offering counsel based on the truth that will really help. But it starts with seeing their problem from their perspective. You know what I think Jonathan did in this story? He said, now what's upsetting Jonathan? Or what's upsetting David in this matter? I think that David's really worried about how my father genuinely feels towards him. I think he's got doubts about whether he really will be king, despite the fact that he's been anointed. I think he's probably worried as to whether I really do love him. He might have some doubts on that score. I think he's concerned as to how we're going to be able to talk about all of this matter and make arrangements in the future. I think he's forgetting God's hand in all of these affairs of life, probably because he's a young man, hasn't quite appreciated the divine hand in the way he should. I don't think he's thinking far enough ahead. I think he's only focusing on today. Now, what can I do to comfort him? And this is what he decided to do. He enacted the role of a comforter to a distraught and a fearful David, and he did all that he could to calm David and to buoy up his spirits to face the future. You see what he did here? In verses 12 and 13, he guaranteed to reveal his father's attitude to David, whether good or evil. In verses 14 and 15, he spoke with conviction and certainty that David would in the future reign as king. In verses 16 and 17, he restated his own vows of affection and his abiding love for David. In verses 18 to 20, he made practical arrangements to ensure that they could talk again in the future. In verses 21 and 22, he reminded David of the providential care of Yahweh in all the trials of life. Yahweh has sent thee away. And here in this verse, the last verse, verse 23, he lifted David's mind to contemplate the final joy of the age to come. You see what he says? As touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of. The word matter, incidentally, is the word dabar, means word. The word which we have spoken of. And the word, of course, was the covenant they'd given each other in verses 16 and 17. They were men of their word. And as touching that word, nothing would happen to break their covenant friendship. And so he says, Yahweh be between me and thee for the Olam. Jonathan expresses his confidence in God's ability to bring them both into the kingdom itself, far beyond their own day, far beyond all the trial of the moment. We'll be together in the Olam, David. And he lifts up his mind to see above and beyond and over the present distress to the joy of the kingdom age to come and to the eternal uniting of the two of them together in covenant friendship. Now, could you do any more to comfort your friend than what Jonathan did to David in this story? Seeing the problem from the other person's perspective and offering counsel that will genuinely help in the truth. And you know, one of the things about David's Psalms, as he writes them as an older man, one of the things that probably impressed all of us about David's Psalms is his ability to see in faith beyond life's trials to the ultimate joy of the kingdom. How many of David's Psalms reflect that spirit? The ability to see beyond today to the joy of the kingdom. And that spirit was nurtured in him by contact with Jonathan. And that's the story, therefore, of this very dramatic episode in the field as Jonathan sought to help his friend. So, Jonathan the comforter. Repeated pledges and quiet consolation. The disciples of Christ are committed to fulfilling the desire of his soul. All our relationships in the truth should be devoid of that spirit of jealousy or envy, and our plans should always invoke Yahweh's guidance in the matter. Honour is a divine precept which should permeate all aspects of our relationships with us, in our families, in our ecclesias, in our schools, in our workplace, with the state. Jonathan was a wonderful upholder of this principle in the dignity and reverence he always accorded his father. Each week the disciples come to renew their covenant and to restate their vows of affection. Friendship at its highest is characterized by warmth and fervency and by that helpful encouragement that is the basis of all godly comfort. These are some of the principles that emerge from this story of the two men in the field on the day when Jonathan, the faithful warrior and the wonderful friend, became in his day Jonathan the comforter.